You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 16th of March 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24. Coming to you from Studio One at Midori House with me, Emma Nelson, and Gillian DeBias.
And coming up on today's programme, now that the hefty award season is over, what cinema is worth watching? Critic Tim Robey will be here to tell us.
I don't understand why this is happening.
You know her?
Would you have treated her differently if she was a man?
That's not what happened.
Em, what is going on?
Steven Soderbergh's Side Effects there. We'll be talking a little bit more about that later on. We'll also be delving into the world of K-pop in our music review, from the sugar-coated delights of this to the slightly more challenging sound of this. The music journalist Robert Barry will be sharing his recommendations with us.
Plus, we'll also be welcoming back theatre critic Matt Wall, fresh off a plane from New York. He'll be telling us what's happening on and off Broadway.
And we'll give you some weekend highlights from Hong Kong, courtesy of David Michon. So lots to look forward to this week on The Review, here on Monocle 24. And to kick off today's cultural highlights, a play has just arrived in London that some critics are saying is one of the most important pieces of theatre to emerge in the past few years. Miss Julie, Strindberg's classic naturalist tale of the struggle between the classes and the sexes, is an established part of the dramatic canon, of course. It's a staple text for drama students. It's a favourite for reworkings too, isn't it, Julie?
Indeed it is. And what's interesting, its latest incarnation places the action in a farmhouse kitchen in contemporary South Africa, where the social and racial tensions between the two lead characters, Miss Julie and the servant John, produce some of the most angry and bloody results seen on stage for a while. We saw it together, Emma, and I think when we came out, neither of us could speak. We were in shock.
It was one of those plays that was so intensely angry and bloody and gruesome and aggressive that I think I said to you as we walked out of the theatre, I'm going to like this in about 3 or 4 days' time, but at the moment I think it's terrible. And it is right. I have completely come round to the idea that it is itself a fabulous piece of theatre. But I wasn't as convinced as the critics, who have all been completely bowled over by it.
I think what I regret was such a busy week that I hadn't read enough about it, and I wish I'd seen the original Strindberg Miss Julie. I think had I seen that and seen this aristocratic woman who suddenly sensually and sexually entices the servant, and what it meant then, and then how clever it was to turn that into a contemporary South African post-apartheid drama, I think I would have got so much more out of it.
It is, but obviously it's good to approach a piece of work as it is in its entirety, and it's probably quite healthy actually to have gone having not known what the Strindberg play was like. But this transposition of this tale between the haughty aristocratic landowner's daughter and her one night bloody brutal affair. Deeply, deeply sexual on stage, very violently sexual on stage, that then ends as everybody knows it's going to end, was possibly some of the most intense pieces of theatre. But the reason why I did not like it is because there seemed to be very little subtlety in it, insofar as the girl Julie, played by the very, very sultry, almost dancerish Hilda Cronje, came on stage and she was angry from the word go. And I think had there been a little bit more subtlety in the performances, it would have made for a much more bearable play, because once you start shouting at minute one, you know you have another 89 minutes of shouting until something desperately awful happens.
But I think right there you just need a little bit of subtlety, and you have to in some way as an audience empathise a little bit with the characters, even though they're meant to be, you know, flawed and unattractive. Otherwise it's unrelenting, and I wanted to hit her.
Yeah, you wanted to hit her. The great thing about the Strindberg play is that all the action happens off stage. This one, what you see is what you get. It is It is deeply gruesome. But it is a very, very clever play insofar as it reworks class differences, but also now that there was the black servants who are now in a position whereby they are reclaiming the land off the white farmers. That, I thought, was a very, very, very clever twist at the end to say actually that the servant who in Strindberg's play doesn't feel constrained by society actually ends up literally the victor in the whole thing. It was quite an astonishing piece of theatre. Go and see it, but be prepared to be a little weary after it. Our next guest is going to see it in a couple of weeks' time, and so Tim Robey, our cinema critic, you have been warned. You're with The Review here on Monocle 24.
And we continue now with film, and with the award season firmly behind us, it's time to focus on a crop of new films that are catching the attention of the critics.
I'm delighted to say that, as I mentioned just a moment ago, critic and regular of The Review here on Monocle 24, Tim Robey, is back in the studio to tell us not only what he's going to be seeing at the theatre, but what he's been seeing at the cinema. Welcome, Tim.
Hi.
We wanted to start off with Steven Soderbergh, who has just announced that, having had one of the most prolific careers in cinema that one could ever imagine, is hanging up his camera and his clapperboard, and off he goes.
Yes, he's said that Side Effects is going to be his last film. He's actually got one more thing that he's working on for television, which is a biopic of Liberace starring Michael Douglas.
Yeah. And Matt Damon.
But that's right. But Side Effects supposedly is his final movie. What's interesting is he began his career with Sex, Lies and Videotape, which is, you know, a four-handed drama. And Side Effects is another four-handed drama. You could call it Sex, Lies and Antidepressants, I thought. It kind of has a lot of the same elements in play.
What's the plot?
Basically, Jude Law plays this very, very wealthy psychologist who is assigned to the case of Rooney Mara, a very depressive patient. And without giving too much away, there's a certain crime committed. And the question is, was it the pills she's taking that kind of drove her to this behaviour? And Jude Law's whole career kind of comes into focus because of this, because he's the one who's prescribed her these drugs. And then it turns into a very kind of twisty and kind of a clever, quite a satisfying thriller, I think, which is right on the edge of trash. I mean, that's what's kind of fun about it.
Soderbergh pulls it back. Said he wanted to do a film a bit like he always enjoyed the thrillers, like Fatal Attraction. And now audiences are so overstimulated, often by effects, that the real genre of the thriller you don't see as much. And so he wanted to create a film that was once again one of those thrillers that everyone ends up talking about at the end when the lights come up.
It's nice because it begins and you think he's going to give you a kind of a treatise on how we're all over-medicated as a society, and it is kind of about that in a way, and you sort of think as though he's taking this rather seriously, and then suddenly it becomes this really slippery, sort of twisty business.
It reminded me, I remember seeing David Mamet's House of Games, mm-hmm. and it's one of those things where it's like the glove keeps turning inside out. You think you've got it, you think you know, and then it just completely spins around.
That's
and baffles you. I thought it exceptionally clever way.
Let's listen to a little clip.
Yeah, great.
911, what's your emergency?
I need help. Someone's been murdered.
There's been an incident.
Where's her lawyer?
She doesn't have one. Just kept talking about you.
I don't understand why this is happening.
You know her?
Would you have treated her differently if she was a man?
That's not what happened.
Em, what is going on?
Put her on a blixer.
I don't think you should be my doctor anymore.
I think she requires more observation.
Someone gets punished.
That, of course, was a clip of Side Effects, the final film offering by Steven Soderbergh. Our film reviewer, Tim Robey, is in the studio with us at the moment. You were going to mention something about the twisting and turning
at
of it.
At any point, you feel as though it could collapse into kind of real trash. What it actually reminds me of is a movie called Final Analysis from the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And if you remember this, with Richard Gere as the psychologist of Uma Thurman and Kim Basinger's characters. And they're playing a game with him and kind of mess up his whole life own career. At any point, you feel as though it could turn into that.
I thought what was amazing is the cinematography, the editing, the music. And when I was reading more about it, I was reading that he was his own cinematographer on this and he edited it.
For most of his career, actually, he's been doing that.
I had no idea.
Yeah, he's got pseudonyms for both of those jobs. Peter Andrews. Peter Andrews, if you see that in the name, his name in the credits, that means Soderbergh shot it himself.
The fact that the plot hinges on the use of antidepressants and the pharma industry. I was astonished to think when I was thinking about how many times the pharma industry has been used as almost the plot linchpin. I think I can think of The Constant Gardener, where it becomes a political argument. But to have something as simple as an antidepressant, which you say is not, it's not the key to the plot, is it? But it is at the same time absolutely integral to it.
It's sort of like the red herring that leads you into the plot, but then he comes back at the end and does make further points about how we take too many drugs as a society. It also ties back in with Traffic, of course, which was his sort of epic about the way that illegal drugs go around the world. And this is about the legal ones, I guess.
Well, in an interview I read with him, he said when he started Sex, Lies and Videotape, the Annie McDowell character is seeing a psychiatrist. And he wouldn't have even contemplated just giving her pills to solve her psychological problem. Now the character goes and sees a psychiatrist and he could only think of giving her pills. And it just shows very much how the nature of society has changed.
I'll say one more thing about Jude Law, who I think is a very uneven actor, but this is him at his best. It reminded me a bit of when he was in I Heart Huckabees, playing this kind of terrible, smug corporate stooge, and you just see him kind of completely de-smugged. And I think that's the best way to see Jude Law. And in this film, he goes from being the kind of the man with all the answers to this guy who just has no idea what's going on in his life.
Which is probably quite satisfying, because one thing that always disappoints me about Jude Law is that he ends up being Jude Law, which always, I hate it when actors do that. Do you think that you say he's good in this. Do you think he sort of manages to stop being Jude Law for 5 minutes?
I think that is part of it. He was absolutely terrible in Soderbergh's last movie, Contagion. Really terrible. Putting on a sort of absurd Australian accent for no reason. And here, he starts as Jude Law. That's the thing. That's the starting point. You're like, oh God, he's being quite kind of complacent and smug. And then the rug is pulled out from under him. The plot just kind of completely leaves him bewildered. And he's kind of ruined and his career is ruined.
But I think it's something with the very naturalistic way Soderbergh directed this that I thought Jude Law was brilliant. And he grew almost into the role. It was very well done.
That was Steven Soderbergh's 28th and reportedly final film, Side Effects. Let's move on to a film which has absolutely gripped me, In the House, Dans la Maison, by the French filmmaker François Ozon. It stars an amazing cast. It's a very, very small cast and is the tale of a 16-year-old boy who becomes a sort of a strange voyeur in a house in which he gives, I think he's giving lessons, maths lessons to his friend, isn't he? And we see the sort of the embroilment of this lad into the house through the prose that he writes for his literature teacher. And it is quite an astonishing film to see how a 16-year-old boy, an excellent actor, it's Ernst Umhauer, who no one had heard of before, and the way that people are actually reacting to this young man as he gets further and further embroiled into a house in the most astonishingly quite queasy way. What was your verdict on it, Tim?
I love this film. I saw it at a festival at the end of last year, and I can't wait to see it again. It's actually out next week. I think Ozon, who's a very prolific director, he seems to make about one film every year. I think it's his best film in maybe a decade, and maybe his best ever, actually. I think it actually combines his two different modes, because he's sometimes kind of playful and funny, like we've saw with Potiche, and sometimes he's quite sort of disturbing and makes kind of interesting, sort of quite sort of sexually ambiguous thrillers, and we saw that in the early parts of his career with films like Water Drops on Burning Rocks. And this combines the two modes really beautifully, I think, and you're never quite sure which way it's going to go, because it's very funny as well as being sort of slippery and suggestive.
Well, I didn't get to see it because my laptop ate up the press copy I was given. So let's have a listen to it and then I can hear more about it from the two of you who have seen it.
Des dialogues percutants, des situations excitantes.
Bonsoir, Milo.
Il est bizarre, il est peut-être dangereux.
Quand j'ai lu,
j'arrivais pas à le croire.
Tu confonds trop tes désirs avec l'histoire.
Et alors?
C'est ce que vous m'avez appris.
Dis-moi, qu'est-ce que tu veux faire?
Est-ce que tu peux m'expliquer ce qu'on vient faire dans cette histoire?
This is an astonishing, just listening there, this is all the characters who are, all of them are fascinated by this young man's narrative. Because what he does, he goes and gives his friend maths lessons in the house. And then when he comes back, he writes about what he's seen. But he makes up a narrative in which he sort of imposes his own critique of their lives. And that in turn is critiqued by his teacher, which in turn is then critiqued by the teacher's wife. And it is an astonishing piece of cinema, I found it, because it's terribly French, because it talks about the great portraits of literature and the way that people, the way that the French are now abandoning their love of literature. And then you get this child who is writing almost like the opposite of Flaubert's Madame Bovary, where you see Madame Bovary, she's living in her world and it's imploding. There is a kind of Madame Bovary character in the middle of it, which is the wife. But then you have this slightly pervy teenager's look about what, you know, what Madame Bovary's life is like from the outside. And that in turn is critiqued. And you miss the fact that this is a teenage boy who is being voyeuristic on a private family. And that's what so makes you so queasy about this film, because you find yourself wanting to know more about the intimacies of the family, and you find yourself almost like the terrible literature teacher who sits down with his wife and artistically analyses the merits of this child's work.
And he's Fabrice Lucchini, as the teacher, is the one who has sort of encouraged him to write about what you know, this is why the kid goes in and starts writing this story, which then takes on a life of its own, and the story starts to dictate what his behaviour is like in this house. And then the teacher is completely, disturbed by this. And then it begins to affect him directly and his wife, Kristen Scott Thomas, who has sort of a slightly smaller role than we might expect her to have, but who is very good in it as well.
She is very, very good. I find her, she has that lovely, she brings that slight Englishness to it, but she herself works in art. And as a result, it almost makes it possible for them to sit and objectively critique this child's work. Whereas in actual fact, any sensible soul would be going round to everybody's parents involved and going, you know, we all need to know about this. This needs to stop now. It's absolutely brilliant.
The other thing that Ozon is, I think, probably thinking about and referring to is all those sort of dramas that we think of where an interloper comes into a household and starts gradually taking over. You think about The Servant, Dirk Bogarde in The Servant, also Terence Stamp in Pasolini's Theorem. These figures who come in and almost everyone around them is sort of in some way seduced or affected by them, including his male friend at school, who's sort of, you know, another interesting character.
The small bit I did see before my laptop at the CD was the opening sequence, which is very stylized, very clever, very stylized. Does that style follow through the storytelling?
I found it very simply told. I found the beginning actually didn't bear any resemblance to the rest of the film because it had sort of great sweeping set pieces at the beginning of as the school in where most of the action takes place is laid out and one thought, oh goodness, it's going to be an argument about the quality of education in this world. That is actually just the simple setup, and then after that you suddenly end up with it would work brilliantly on stage actually because it's terribly intimate.
It would. I think the biggest stylistic coup is at the very end. There's a shot, sort of a tableau, which isn't giving anything away, but he's thinking about in that shot he's thinking about Rear Window. He's thinking about all the little stories, the vignettes of people's lives in the house across the street kind of thing, that you're peering in through the window and wondering what might be going on.
That interesting? Because Side Effects also has that kind of Rear Window.
It absolutely does.
Opening and closing.
Absolutely does, yeah.
Tim Robey, thank you so much for joining us here on The Review, reviewing two films which are getting the Universal's thumbs up from here within Studio One. That is a rare thing indeed. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. Stay with us because in a moment we go on a cultural journey around the world.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
You don't write a book lightly, and I didn't really want to write a book, so I had to find something which could only be explained in a book.
Take the Global Pulse.
Singapore is too small to have a known huge art scene to be competitive on a global level.
The old distinction between policy being made in London and executed by diplomats abroad has gone.
A lot of people come south for the opium harvest, and literally as soon as the last opium poppy is harvested, they will then take up arms and fight for a few weeks. It's purely practical.
And occasionally take things down a notch too.
I mean, if someone wants to buy it for $100 million, we would sell it.
Our radio station's got quite a wealthy demographic. I think you're in the right place.
To end the week with the best chat.
I've been confused for Kenny Loggins, actually.
I want to start with a very simple question. Why did we go to war with Iraq?
Some great music.
A grand piano is kind of a condescending icon at this point.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
Welcome back. It's Saturday and you are listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Gillian DeBias and Emma Nelson.
And I think we should just mention that the films that we've just been talking about, Steven Soderbergh's Side Effects, is out now in the house. Dans la Maison, directed by François Ozon, is out on the 29th of March in the United Kingdom, but has already come out elsewhere, especially in Europe. Now, it's time of the show again, where our associate editor, Nelly Gocheva, a busy lady, talks us through some of the cultural highlights she's unearthed from around the world this weekend.
In Hong Kong this weekend, Korean artist Lee Bull's works are on display at the new Lehman Maupin's Gallery. Having risen to international fame in the 1990s with her futuristic installations, Bull is one of the most forward-thinking Asian artists of her generation. Expect ink and acrylic paintings along with metal sculptures. The exhibit is on until the 11th of May. Vancouver Art Gallery is hosting an exhibition by Paris-born painter and photographer Patrick Feigenbaum, renowned for his large-scale portraits. This is the first major showing of his work in Canada. The exhibition features over 75 photos and is on until the 2nd of June. London's Royal Academy of Arts welcomes a new George Bellows exhibition entitled Modern American Life. Bellows' works show a grittier side of New York in the opening years of the 20th century. From dock workers to boxers, Bellows portrays the working class people and neighborhoods of the city. For more information, go to royalacademy.org.uk. John Scott's dance show, The White Piece, premieres in New York this weekend. The 55-minute performance explores issues ranging from political asylum to racism, survival, and love. Featuring a cast of 14 dancers, The White Piece runs for 2 weeks in downtown Manhattan at La Mama's Ellen Stewart Theatre. For more information, go to lamama.org. Finally, on our record players this weekend, we have Berlin dance trio Brand Brouwer Frick with their third album entitled Miami. And now let's hear Broken Pieces. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gocheva.
That was Broken Pieces by Brent Brouwer Frick, featuring Jamie Liddell, who was a guest on Culture a couple of weeks ago on Culture on the 4th of March, ending that report there by Nelly Gocheva. Time now for our weekly music review. As regular listeners to Monocle 24 will know, we are no strangers to pop music from Asia. J-pop, T-pop, K-pop, featuring heavily on the Monocle playlist, names from South Korea like CN Blue, Girls' Generation, BoA and Rainbow and Sister 19 may well be familiar to you. They are indeed familiar to us.
Our guest this week is a music journalist with a particular interest in the colourful manic and sometimes psychedelic pop music that comes out of South Korea. We go over to Paris now to say hello to Robert Berry. Hello, Robert.
Hello.
So you're a British journalist based in Paris. Why such a big interest in South Korean music?
Well, I guess I first came across Korean pop a few years ago when a friend of mine, Gweno, who's actually a Welsh language pop singer, heard this track, Nobody, by the Wonder Girls. I think it was on radio in America at the time. This must have been about 3 or 4 years ago now. And it's just such a great song, so well produced, you know, and the melody got stuck in my head. And I guess it all spun from that, you know. And then last year with, you know, all the business around Gangnam Style and things, there was obviously a lot of attention on South Korean pop music. And so I was, you know, commissioned to write an article about that for The Quietus.
And obviously the rest is history. And what I find amazing, Robert, is that there is something so distinct that sets it apart from English language pop music or any other kind of pop music. And I'm still struggling to work out what it is, because it sounds all the components are so familiar, and yet it seems so different and so unique. What can you help me here?
Yeah, well, I think you're right in a way. There is this sort of hybridity to it that you know, it's kind of picking and choosing little bits of Western music and, but almost kind of accelerating it, you know. It's like it's a kind of accelerated pop music, almost, it seems to me. Not necessarily like the tempos are faster, but it's like sort of hyped up and taking all the most, what seems to me, all the most sort of futuristic elements of pop music in the West from whatever the last 10 or 20 years, and blending them all together in this way that just sounds like you know, something from a science fiction film or something.
And of course, for K-pop, the music videos are hugely important. They invest a lot in these with the best sort of talent going in South Korea.
Yeah, and again, the music videos, you know, they look often like they're set on board a spaceship or something. You know, they're often set in these strange kind of like non-places where you can't really tell where you are. It's just this kind of CGI landscape. So you're sort of lost out of time almost, you know.
What I'm quite interested in now is where K-pop is going to go, because you mentioned Psy and Gangnam Style, which meant that every teenager in the world, regardless of as whether they could understand it or knew where Gangnam was, suddenly were doing the horse dance, and it was just quite baffling, because we'd been championing K-pop for quite a while on Monocle 24, and then suddenly everybody knew what it was. Where do you think it's going to go next? Because do you think Psy was just a one-off?
Well, that's hard to say. I mean, Psy is obviously a very charismatic and talented character, you know, and maybe he is kind of one of a kind in that way. He doesn't seem to be particularly representative of the mainstream of Korean pop music. And what's almost more interesting to me about Gangnam Style is this bizarre spectacle of everyone from career politicians to internationally recognized conceptual artists filming themselves doing this dance, you know, which I'm not sure what that says about music, but it certainly seems to say something about the effect that YouTube has had on popular culture around the world.
Well, you've gathered up some samples for us to listen to. Let's have a listen to the first one, which is the Wonder Girls, Tell Me.
And that was The Wonder Girls and Tell Me. It was it's a choice of our music reviewer, Robert Barry, a Paris-based music journalist and fan of all things K and J-pop. Robert, why did you choose that? I think it's one of the first things that The Wonder Girls ever did, isn't it?
Yeah, it was one of their first big hits. I mean, to me, it's just a wonderful sounding song. You know, it's got this great little catchy hooks. It's this strange sort of arcade game feel to it, and a lot of the sounds and beeps and buzzes and stuff going around. I mean, it just grabs me on a very immediate level, you know, I mean.
And South Korea, they do like their girl bands, and it seems that, you know, where we're used to girl bands of four, they seem to multiply there. It's almost like a big orchestral chorus of girls and girl bands in South Korea.
It's true. I mean, the Wonder Girls, they've got about 10 members, you know, and they have these subgroups and things that'll split off and do these solo projects, and then they all reunite and get back together, you know. It's like... again, it's this sort of sense of acceleration, you know, where a band will break up and then reunite for the comeback tour within the space of a couple of years, you know.
It is quite astonishing, and it's astonishing to watch because, like we said, we've mentioned the videos already, there is a cartoonish element to this, isn't there?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. this sense where you almost get real people that are trying to make themselves look artificial, it seems to me. You know, like, and there was a case in Japan, I think last year or something, where one of the big girl groups in Japan announced they had a new member. And it turned out that this new member was a kind of artificial intelligence construct that had been kind of pinned together out of the different members. And it almost seems to me like the opposite thing is happening in Korea, where instead of there being a kind of computer-generated construct that pretends to be a human, there are humans that are almost pretending to be computer-generated constructs. You know?
So are these girl bands, you know, all homegrown talent? Or is it the case that a lot of people, let's say South Koreans from North America, from all over the world, come to kind of audition to be now big K-pop stars in Seoul?
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, it's a bit of both, I think. Like, I think certainly this band called Girls' Generation, I think quite a lot of members of Girls' Generation, who, you know, one of the big K-pop girl groups at the moment, a lot of them are actually kind of, born in America and moved to Seoul, in order to become stars, I guess.
Let's move on and hear a little bit more K-pop. This is a track that's more recent, and it's a group who are a staple on the Monocle 24 playlist as ever. This is Kara and Pandora. Robert, what are your thoughts on this before we hear it?
Well, I mean, for this song, it doesn't quite have the same sort of arcade game feel to it. But when the chorus comes in on this track, the first time I heard it, I was just completely blown away. It's such an incredibly crafted melody, I think. It's a great piece of pop songwriting.
Let's have a listen. That was Kara and Pandora, getting the thumbs up from our producer, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, this morning. And whenever I listen to that kind of music, Robert, and when I have to introduce it on Monocle 24, I do often feel as if I've eaten 10 bags of sweets, and I have confessed on air to needing to go and lie down in a dark room.
And you'll find her dancing in the studio to it. Be under no illusion.
Sure.
There is something about it, though, that makes me think that I should be in a spin studio when I listen to that kind of stuff.
In a what studio?
Sorry? In a spinning studio, or doing something breathlessly
aerobic.
Energetic in an aerobics class.
Yes, I see what you mean. Yeah, yeah. There is this sense of tremendous energy to it, isn't there? I guess. Yeah.
It is quite astonishing. And what has interested me about that particular track is when you look it up, there is a wide amount of coverage of the fact that there was a bit of scandal in the video, that these ladies who are essentially in a suit with big knickers whip their jackets off for just a split second and expose a little bit of back, which I just thought was quite interesting, given the fact that, you know, to all intents and purposes, they've got nothing on their legs. I mean, really, they've got they're in their underwear. But there is this sort of sense of slight prurience to all this, isn't there?
Well, yes and no. I mean, is it? Couldn't you say just as much about English pop music and American pop music? You know, I mean, in many ways, it's almost more reserved to South Korean music, perhaps, in some cases. But, I mean, certainly the idea of women in pop being, you know, sexualized is nothing that's been invented in South Korea in recent years. There's a very long history to this, you know.
And the South Korean music scene isn't just about sugary pop music. You've found some experimental music that's drawn your attention. Can you tell us a little bit about Ten and Makido?
Yeah, well, I mean, I know very little about them, to be honest. I found that there was a great portal on the Wire magazine published a couple of years ago, which had links to all sorts of really interesting experimental and improvised, particularly electronic stuff from South Korea. Circles like Dottolim and Relay and improvising musicians like Soo Jong Ki and Park Jang Soo. And then I just came across this one group called Ten. Maybe there's an amazing picture of them on the Wire website. But this one track particularly stood out for me as something that didn't sound like the normal kind of spidery, post-weather, Webernian sort of non-idiomatic improvisation that one expects. This this 10 track really sounded like something extraordinary.
Let's have a listen to it. That was 10, Itta and Marquita. That track was called Spectacle. It's a musical choice of our reviewer today, Robert Barry, a Paris-based British music journalist. Where is the market for that kind of music, Robert?
Well, where's the market for it? I don't know. I mean, I suppose, in a way, the idea of thinking about where's the market for X or Y is slightly alien to my way of thinking, you know, but clearly the kind of people who read The Wire magazine and things like that could get into that, you know, and I mean, I'm the market for that kind of music, I suppose. I have a very broad Catholic taste.
And based in Paris, Paris is no stranger to embracing music from other cultures in a way that possibly other cities might not be so open to it. Are lots of people in France, for example, listening to J-pop and K-pop?
I guess so. I mean, there was a big concert a couple of years ago by Girls' Generation at a huge venue in Paris that people from all over Europe were travelling to, and there was, you know, people queuing and massive, massive attention to that. I mean, it's not like I know loads of people in Paris who were all going crazy about this stuff. I mean, I found this stuff the same way that most people did, probably through the internet, you know, and the internet is this sort of placeless place, though, where it's almost irrelevant where I'm based, you know.
Robert, thank you very much indeed for your time. Thank you for joining us on the line. That was Robert Barry, the France-based British music journalist, bringing his selection of K-pop to today's review.
And this is the review on Monocle 24, where it's time for our weekly city look ahead. And today we're crossing to Hong Kong.
Our managing editor, David Michon, has been over in our Hong Kong bureau for a few days. Here's his guide to what's happening there this weekend.
For a city not known for its cultural ventures, this weekend Hong Kongers are spoiled for choice. This Sunday, the 37th Hong Kong International Film Festival kicks off, opening with the world premiere of hometown director Herman Yao's Ip Man, The Final Fight. It's not the first film that reinvents the life of Wong Chai Grandmaster Ip Man. He's also the lead character in Wong Kar-wai's new film. But Yao's take on the local legend is a worthy one and not to be missed. This weekend, you can also take in Hong Kong's first affordable art fair, the latest addition to Will Ramsey's enterprise. 84 galleries are involved with over 750 artists showing, and works are for sale for as little as 1,000 Hong Kong dollars, or around 100 euros. The affordable art fair is held at the Harbourfront Convention and Exhibition Center. For theater lovers, head to the Shusun Theater on Saturday and take in Paul Poon's The Emperor, His Mom, A Eunuch, and a Man, described as a thought-provoking commentary on the absurdity of past and present through the mystery behind the execution of one empress's favorite eunuch. Well, we're intrigued. And finally, this week is your last chance for the Hong Kong Arts Festival, which runs until March 22nd. We suggest Grammy Award-winning American jazz vocalist and bassist Esperanza Spalding. Catch her performance at the HK Cultural Center in Kowloon. For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm David Michon.
Where is the throne for you whose tender strength can heal a thousand souls? Everyone you touch just many have tried.
And that was Esperanza Spalding with Crowned and Kissed there, finishing off our managing editor David Michon's look ahead from Hong Kong. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We'll be crossing over and talking about Broadway, so don't go away.
Section D is the show you listen to for the untold stories, secrets, and blazing headlines in the design sphere. The architects, fashion followers, artists, and engineers who are making and breaking the trends across the world.
When Valentino touches the clothes, you see his hands tracing those lines of shape, form, and to see Valentino arranging one of his dresses is to understand the dress in terms of structure.
Join me, Hugo MacDonald, for an hour of insight, interviews and discussion every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24. If you're looking for a present for a loved one, something for the home, or some luggage to take on the road, why not visit one of our shops? Our beautifully appointed shops in London, New York, Toronto, Hong Kong, and Tokyo sell a selection of the fruits of our collaborations with a number of our favourite brands, including Porter, Hackett, Ettinger, Barena, and many others too. Plus, we can also help out filling in any gaps in your collection of back issues. So why not visit any of our shops today? You're guaranteed a very warm welcome.
Welcome back to Studio One here at Midori House. This is a review on Monocle 24 with Emma Nelson and Gillian De Bias.
Now, every so often we like to gaze across the Atlantic, rather enviably, I have to say, to discover the new and noteworthy theatre productions playing on and off Broadway.
And I'm delighted to welcome our friend Matt Wolfe into the studio now, fresh off the plane from New York. Welcome, Matt. You're the IHT... Let's announce you properly, your job title. You're the international... The IHT's a theatre critic.
Exactly,
so
right.
Let's do you a little, little bit of justice. Filling the international section of your job this week.
Yes, yes. Well, if one has to go to New York theater at any time of year, March, April, May are the times to go. I mean, we Americans are obsessed with awards. And what happens in New York, March, April, May is all the theater awards hove into view. It's exactly like the Oscars with all the big movies opening in December. So New York is getting a big concentration of stuff.
So you're just hot off the plane. How many productions did you see in what period of time?
I was there for 5 days properly, and I saw 6 shows, which
That's
was the maximum amount. I mean, in other words, if there was a performance time, I was at a show. So, and what's interesting is that a lot of actors who don't need to do theater are doing it, and they're certainly not doing it for the money, because there isn't much money to be made, particularly off Broadway, but there seems to be the appetite. So anyone who says theater is dying, don't say that to the actors.
When you're saying that a lot of theaters who don't need to do it, are we
a lot of actors?
We're talking about those who are possibly not in the hand-to-mouth category.
We are. I mean, for instance, Jesse Eisenberg, who's not even 30, has written and is co-starring opposite, if you please, Vanessa Redgrave, in a play in a theater way down in Greenwich Village that seats 186. And, you know, you would think he'd be on some sort of Hollywood A-list tooting around L.A. And instead, he's doing this play 8 shows a week called The Revisionist, in which he plays a pretty obnoxious equivalent to the character he played in The Social Network, who in this case is a frustrated writer who goes to Poland to revise a science fiction novel with which he's not satisfied, and he goes to stay with a distant elderly cousin of his played by Miss Redgrave, and that's the play.
Well, doesn't it show, though, that these big name actors, you know, who've made their name perhaps on screen, their love of acting, really, they want to flex muscles that screen acting don't allow them to. And so theatre is the best vehicle for that.
That's exactly right. I mean, every so often, I think it was 7 years ago now or something like that, Julia Roberts deigned Broadway with her presence in a play called 3 Days of Rain, since which time she hasn't set foot near Broadway, at least on stage. She might have gone to a show. But what's interesting are actors like Ethan Hawke, who, I mean, I know he's not in the Julia Roberts category, but he's still a pretty well-known film actor. He has an Oscar nomination for Training Day, and he's in an off-Broadway play at the moment called Clive, which he directed. And this is his second off-Broadway show of the season. Now, I don't know what his agent would say about that, but he's doing it for the art.
One wonders, though, when you get someone like Ethan Hawke. I mean, Jesse Eisenberg and Ethan Hawke are two very, very different characters, because arguably Jesse Eisenberg is very much a star in the ascendant.
Right.
And if he can cement his career as a writer as well as a director at this stage, then who knows where this man's talents will lead him. Ethan Hawke, on the other hand, one would, not to be too, you know, disrespectful of Mr. Hawke, is not in the ascendant. And the fact that he's doing two plays, does that smack a little of desperation?
Or has he just fallen back in love with the stage? I think
that's a little bit unfair, if only because it's not as if he thought, oh, well, I'm not getting cast for, you know, Godzilla 5 or whatever. I'm going to go back and do my Bertolt Brecht. I'm going to give New York my Bertolt Brecht. I mean, the fact of the matter is, even dating back to his early film Renown in Dead Poets Society, he was a creature of the off-Broadway stage, yeah, opposite actors like Robert Sean Leonard, who then, of course, has become famous on television through House. But that's a generation where they were weaned in the New York theater. What's interesting also is both Ethan Hawke and Jesse Eisenberg are not doing big Broadway, you know, shebang lavish productions. They're doing these kind of quirky off-Broadway experimental shows to audiences that are there to see the work as much as to see them.
And also, to a certain extent, when you have a reputation on screen as a star, it's kind of a risky thing to do because theater exposes you in a way that film doesn't. So it's in many ways quite brave.
Well, I think so. And particularly with Jesse Eisenberg, whose his play The Revisionist has a cast of three. And you know, yes, he wrote it, so he's in the driver's seat. But when your female leading person is Vanessa Redgrave, who, as my colleague Ben Brantley, The New York Times said, is the greatest actress of her generation, you think that's not necessarily setting the bar for yourself very low. That, in other words, you've got a lot to match.
Miss Redgrave must at some stage have said yes. So that's almost testament. That's a stamp of approval for Jesse Eisenberg.
I absolutely, and in a way, that's almost the most moving thing about the production is her participation in it, because, yes, he's an Oscar nominee and all that, but he's an untested writer. He had, I have to say, written one previous off-Broadway play, which I didn't see, but, you know, he's not in any way proven as a writer, and he's not that tested even as an actor. But I think Miss Redgrave, like Judi Dench at the moment in London, who's doing the world premiere, mm-hmm, of a new play called Peter and Alice, it's interesting when these great legends of the British theatre try new work, not just another Ibsen or Chekhov play.
So you've seen both The Revisionist and Ethan Hawke's Clive. Do you think of them?
I thought Clive was diabolical. I'm very, very sorry to say. It's one of those, it's an adaptation by a writer called Jonathan Mark Sherman, who's actually also in the production. It's an adaptation of one of Bertolt Brecht's very early plays called Baal, B-A-A-L, written in 1918. And it's a young man's play, and it just comes across as really self-indulgent. And it's one of those things where the actors, I'm sure, are having a fantastic time, but it doesn't cross the footlights. The Revisionist it's interesting. I think Jesse Eisenberg, rather fascinatingly, is making a bit of a fetish out of constructing roles for himself or agreeing to roles to play for himself where he is about as unlikable as you can be. And in The Social Network, I mean, yes, he was playing a real-life man who is, of course, still very much with us. And so there was an actual prototype. This is an entirely fictitious character. And the character is so self-absorbed and solipsistic. And he goes to stay with this elderly relation in Poland. And you actually think, why didn't she throw him out after 5 minutes? But he has written a stonking great star part for Miss Redgrave. And it's one of the best things she's ever done on stage. She is absolutely wonderful.
So when you look through all the listings and all the plays that are on Broadway, just off Broadway, and then you come back and you look at what's on the West End here in London and the Fringe here in London, what is the difference? What are the stories that maybe some of the new writers on Broadway and off Broadway are preoccupied with?
Well, I'll tell you one real difference is that shows in London, and this is one of the reasons I live in London, show that there's probably greater breadth and diversity in London, although there isn't at the moment a version in London of Brecht's Baal, thank heavens. But because of the not-for-profit, or should I say state-subsidized aspect of the British theatre, what is really increasingly true in New York is that shows don't have very big casts. I mean, The Revisionist having a cast of three is practically epic. Still to come this season in New York, we've got a one-woman show with Fiona Shaw. We've got a one-woman show with Bette Midler. We've got a one-man version of Macbeth with Alan Cumming. And of course, it's not just that these are star vehicles for these actors. It's that producers are like, one person, bravo.
What is this therefore doing to the industry? Because if you have such a small number of people who actually appear on stage, and always they're trying to get the bigger names in order to sell tickets, where do the up-and-coming actors then cut their teeth?
Well, that's a very, very good question. And I would argue, I mean, you know, there is a regional theater in America, which people don't talk about, but it's very strong, particularly in places like Chicago, Seattle, Washington, San Francisco. I'm guessing that this is true, but I would venture a bet that more people are employed at the National Theater of Great Britain right now across its three auditoria than probably across all the Broadway shows running at the moment.
And what are your thoughts about how that might shape the future of Broadway?
Well, you know, the old sort of adage about where Broadway is headed is that there will be one Broadway show playing to an audience of one, costing $1 million a ticket 8 times a week.
Please
and
say no.
when you see that the Book of Mormon on Broadway, not in London where it's in preview, but on Broadway, is charging and getting $477 a ticket from people who are very happy to pay it because it's the in thing to see. $477 a ticket.
Because that's now significantly more than a top-class opera, which has always been the big bucks ticket.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about that is that the Metropolitan Opera in New York has, shock horror, lowered its prices because they have been a victim of their own success with these Live from the Met broadcasts that are shown in the UK and around the world. A lot of people are saying, great, I'll go see it at my local cinema for $30 or $40. I'm not going to fly to New York and pay hundreds of dollars. So actually, opera now in New York is, relatively speaking, a good deal.
When you talk about, you know, the stars being lured into to productions, do you think there's a danger that the stars will actually have too much say in terms of what's being offered will then be really closely related to what the stars actually want to play and so influence the programming?
That's actually a really interesting question. I'm curious to see that of the shows coming up, which I have yet to see and will report on in due course. Bette Midler's one-woman show, she plays a no longer living, but once very powerful Hollywood agent called Sue Mengers. Now, the question is she accommodating herself to this woman, or is she bending the legacy of Sue Mengers to suit her? You know, in other words, is Sue Mengers a version of her?
I'm thinking at the moment about the way that stars are now, as Gillian mentioned, driving the list of what we can all see. I must confess, I fell victim to the David Tennant Richard II.
And you've already booked.
I've already
along
booked.
With half of the UK.
Along with half of
exactly
the UK.
Exactly right.
But it is, I mean, I think it's brilliant because I'll go and watch David Tennant read out a shopping list because I think he's absolutely fantastic. I also think it's absolutely fantastic that he's bringing a difficult Shakespeare play to the stage.
Yes.
And he is bringing a new audience to the theatre.
Which is absolutely crucial. Now, when you look at the same thing happening in Broadway, I think we're looking at Scarlett Johansson coming and doing Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Yes.
What is she contributing to the theatre in that?
Well, what's very interesting about her, I mean, let's remember, she's 28. She has done one Broadway show in her life, which was a couple of years ago. It was a revival with Liev Schreiber of Arthur Miller's View from the Bridge. For that production, she won a Tony Award in her Broadway debut. Here she is back playing Maggie the Cat in Tennessee Williams' Pulitzer Prize winner. And if anyone knows that three-act play, the first act of the three-act play is basically an hour-long monologue for Maggie, and you have to have serious chops. And I thought she gave it a really good go, but what she doesn't have, because she hasn't had the opportunity to acquire it, is the training that would make that easy for her to do. So you feel her pushing the verbal arias really up a very steep hill.
She's also a tiny bit younger, I'd argue, for that.
She probably is. I mean, it's an interesting production to see because Ciarán Hinds, who, of course, is Irish, not in any way American, is playing the archetypal, you know, American Southern patriarch Big Daddy. And the brick, Maggie the Cat's rather limp in every sense of the word husband, is played by an actor called Benjamin Walker, whose mother-in-law you may have heard of. Her name is Meryl Streep. So it's got an interesting patina to it. It's directed by Rob Ashford, who's American, but he's done a lot of stuff here at the Donmar. And I think this is a Donmar production inflated beyond its natural size.
Matt Wolfe, I'm afraid we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us here on The Review. That brings us to the end of our programme. Our thanks to Fernanda Augusto Pacheco and Katie Bilbao, our producers. Goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.